This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good evening. What a turnout is this? It's amazing. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephanie Bull, and I'm the acting director here at the National Museum of Australia. Now, I would like to start by acknowledging the Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, who are the traditional custodians of this land on which we are meeting, and pay respect to their elders both past and present. I extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in attendance today. We are honoured to have such a stellar panel here with us tonight. Tonight we will be revisiting the history-making role of Australia in the Apollo moon landing. The panel here tonight will discuss how this central role in tracking Apollo and relaying the video feed came about, the extraordinary challenges the team faced, including technical hurdles and last-minute changes. In July 1969, Canberra was at the heart of the Apollo missions to land on the moon. And tonight's panel's discussion is a rare opportunity to hear first-hand accounts of when Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station transmitted the live television coverage of Neil Armstrong's giant first step to a worldwide audience of 600 million people. I would like to welcome Andrew Tink, author of the recent book Honeysuckle Creek, the story of Tom Reed, A Little Dish and Neil Armstrong's First Step, and former Liberal MP in the New South Wales Parliament. Andrew's first book, William Charles Wentworth, won the Nib Award for Literature in 2010. His other books are Lord Sydney, Air Disaster Canberra, and Australia, 1901 to 2001. Andrew is our esteemed host for the evening and will shortly introduce you to our panellists. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to everyone here tonight, but especially to all those trackers from around Australia who are here in the audience, and also those who are joining us through YouTube watching the event live streamed. Your efforts at Honeysuckle Creek and other Australian facilities, including Tidbinbilla and Carnarvon tracking stations and the Parkes radio telescope, contributed to this defining moment in Australian and world history. I also welcome Mr. Anthony Murfitt, Deputy Head of the Australian Space Agency, who is able to join us tonight. And as some of you might know, we have a very special guest here with us tonight. Please welcome astronaut Dr. Andy Thomas, who joins us for this remarkable panel event. Dr. Thomas's achievements include 4 space shuttle flights between 1996 and 2005, 177 days in space, a spacewalk, and 4 months living in zero gravity on a Mir space station. Now, before I hand over to Andrew, I'd like to share this observation by Neil Armstrong in a letter he sent to the Canberra Honeysuckle trackers on the 40th anniversary of the moon landing in 2009. It was an exciting time for many of you, and it certainly was exciting for me. We were involved in doing what many thought to be impossible, putting humans on Earth's moon. Science fiction writers thought it would be possible. H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, and other authors found ways to get people to the moon. But none of those writers foresaw any possibility of the lunar explorers being able to communicate with Earth transmit data, position information, or transmit moving pictures of what they saw back to Earth. The authors foresaw my part of the adventure, but your part was beyond their comprehension. I'd like now to hand over to Andrew, who will introduce the panel.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Stephanie. I too would like to pay my respects to the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of this land, and to acknowledge their elders past, present and future. The panel with me tonight are nearest to me, Mike Dinn, the former Deputy Director, Brian Sullivan, who was a computer technician and programmer, Gillian Schonborn, who was a communications technician, and John Saxon, who was the operations supervisor on the day of the moon landing. Now, we're going to have a little bit of fun later because we've got a photo of each of them as they look 50 years ago, and we're going to get them to sort of introduce themselves a little bit more fully in a few moments. But what I want to do now is just talk about two things by way of introduction. First of all, how the tracking station worked, and then secondly, a little bit about Lunar TV and what that was all about. But before I go there, can I just ask those in the room who had anything to do with Apollo 11 on the day, whether you're at Honeysuckle, Tidbinbilla, or anywhere else for that matter, or working in OTC or the PMG or whatever, could you please raise your hands if you're involved back then? Yeah, that's wonderful. That's really wonderful. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you. Now, I've got a bit of a request of you, please. I'm going to make a few mistakes during the evening because I'm a lawyer politician and know diddly squat about science, tracking and engineering, except what these guys have told me. So if I make mistakes, please don't correct my work while we're up here talking. Okay, so first of all, tracking station. Can we have the first image up, please, of the Honeysuckle tracking station? That's basically Honeysuckle as it appeared in 1969, an 85-foot dish at the top of the hill, and then the operations building in the near foreground there. There were three of these tracking stations around the world. Apart from Honeysuckle here in Canberra, there was Madrid in Spain, or near Madrid, and there was also Goldstone in California. No accident that there were three in those locations, because the Earth spins once every 24 hours on its own axis, the Moon remains relatively static in the sky during an Apollo mission, and so for NASA to keep continuous communication with astronauts on or near the Moon, with the Earth spinning around, they needed three tracking stations, each of which had a view period of about 8 hours, give or take, and some overlap. So what did the tracking stations do? Well, basically they kept mission control in touch with astronauts on or near the Moon. I put it this way, but for these three tracking stations, mission control would have been deaf, dumb and blind to astronauts on the Moon, and the astronauts on the Moon would have been deaf, dumb and blind to the people at mission control. These three stations were as important to an Apollo program as the Saturn V rocket that hurled them up into space. And unless these three stations were in a state of green light readiness, there would be no launch at the Cape. They were that fundamentally important. So what did they do? They had an uplink. They could generate an uplink, a very powerful uplink, to travel a quarter of a million miles across space. That carried voice. It carried remote commands to the spacecraft. And it carried a ranging code, which was bounced back down. The ranging code would tell mission control where the astronauts were at any time. The downlink, coming back from the spacecraft, especially when it was the lunar module, just a tiny little thing, the computers were very small, the transmitters on the lunar module very small, and so these were very powerful receiving dishes, and they could receive these faint signals and then enhance them and send them on to mission control. Put it this way, in relation to voice, it was possible, and there was only ever one person, and Andy might correct me, but only ever one person at mission control who had authority to speak to the astronauts, and he was called the CAPCOM, and he was an astronaut himself. He did all the speaking on behalf of mission control to the astronauts in space. So his voice would go up, and then Armstrong or Aldrin, when they were on the moon, would be able to reply. These signals travel at 186,000 miles a second. The distance of the moon is 250,000 miles. They could almost carry on a conversation in real time. Not quite, but pretty much. Also coming on the downlink, and these guys will tell you it was really the centrepiece of tracking, not TV, that was the frippery as far as they're concerned, was telemetry. So mission control would know what Armstrong's heart rate was when he stepped onto the moon. And in fact, it was 112 beats a minute. Aldrin lounging around in the lunar module was only 81 beats a minute. So Neil Armstrong, despite the way he sounded, was really pumping away there. They also carried things like heart rates, respiration rates, fuel levels in the lunar module. All that sort of thing was incredibly important downlink data. And they were backed up in Canberra here by Tidbinbilla. Tidbinbilla was what was known as a wing station, just as capable as Honeysuckle Creek, and they shared the load at times, but more of that later. And also, right towards the end, just before the Apollo 11 launch, Parkes was brought on board as an extra downlink facility. Parkes couldn't transmit anything. It's a radio telescope. All it could do was receive, but it was a good receiver. And so it was an extra link in the chain to add, as the engineers say, redundancy in case any other system broke down. So that's just a thumbnail sketch of the tracking station's work. Now, the other thing I'd like to talk about briefly is TV, and if we could just go to the TV, the shot of the lunar TV, I think it's shot, let me see here, photo B. Can we just put photo B up, please? No, that's the servo ball. Yeah. Photo B is the upside down camera. Can you get that up? Yeah. Okay, so right from the time that, just after President Kennedy made his promise to put a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth, a debate broke out within NASA about whether or not it was necessary or desirable to try and film this first step live to a worldwide audience. The people who were against doing that, and there were many of them, said TV has nothing to do with the safety of this mission. It's not at all important when it comes to whether or not this mission will succeed or fail, or really anything to do with the astronaut safety. They in fact said it could actually be dangerous because in those days TV cameras weighed a lot and weight on the lunar module was absolutely critical. Those in favour said, well, American taxpayers, and I've got four friends of mine here from Arizona, and you know, American taxpayers, their ilk, were saying, we paid billions of dollars to support this program. The least we can do is see it live in our lounge rooms when whoever it is steps onto the moon. And that debate went on for about 10 years. In the meantime, NASA made a decision to proceed with the development of a camera on the off chance the go-ahead was given. And so this tiny little lightweight camera was developed, an absolute miracle of technology developed by Stan LaBar. Weighed only 6 pounds, looked like a lopsided baking dish, could withstand the heat and cold of the moon, the light and the dark, all the rest of it. There was just one problem. Even at its size, there was difficulty stowing it in the lunar module. So it was stowed in an external stowage bay, and the only way they could stow it was upside down. So it would begin filming from an upside down position. So on each of the TV monitors at the tracking stations, there was a little switch inserted, worth about 5 cents in a hardware store back in the day. And each of the tracking station technicians that were responsible for TV had to remember to flip the switch the other way around to flip the upside down picture the right way up. And this becomes very important in the story a little later on. Anyway, it wasn't till late June in 1969 that the go-ahead was given for Lunar Television, and this little camera was included. And just before we go on, I've already jumped a point. Can we just go back, please, and show the Collins servo ball clip, please? You saw there footage of the servo ball in operation at Honeysuckle Creek. That was Honeysuckle Creek. And the servo ball, thanks to an anonymous donor who I think is in the audience, but I'm sworn not to say who, has donated this servo ball to this museum. And later on, back here, they'll show the display of various things associated with Apollo 11. And taking pride of place in the middle is that servo ball. Now, in the real world, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but in the real world, the dish was driven by computer. But wherever it had to be driven manually, it was driven by that servo ball. And I would describe it as something equivalent to a modern-day computer mouse in the way that it operated. All right, well, now it's about time these guys had a bit of a go. So I will now introduce each of them in turn. So we can show photo C, please. This guy right here. So, come on, Mike.
You can see it gave me grey hairs doing this job. Didn't have a single grey hair at that time. I was Tom Rees' deputy at Honeysuckle. Both Tom and I arrived about the same time. Tom moved from the Rural Valley station about mid-67. I came on board about August 67. From Tidbinbilla. I'd had about 18 months at Tidbinbilla working on the Surveyor soft landing on the moon, and that experience read over fairly well. And one of the roles of the Department Supply Deputy Director, which I was to be closely involved with operations, sit and run operations in real time. So I sat in what we call the left-hand seat of operations for Apollo 7 through 13. So that was my role, Andrew.
Thank you. Next photo, please. John Saxon.
Well. who is that handsome young bloke? I don't know. I don't recognise him.
Read aloud and clear is the expression.
No, I was just so incredibly lucky to collect that job.
So you're operations supervisor, so just tell us what that involved briefly, please.
Well, it was a two-man console, and the man on the left was controlling the station as a whole and answering to various positions at Houston. Man on the right was controlling command, telemetry, voice, and answering a different set of people at Houston. Okay. So it's all good fun. Enjoyed it.
Next photo, please. I don't recognise you.
The glasses.
Come on, Brian. Brian Sullivan.
I joined Honeysuckle Creek in 1966, and I was only 26 years old, and the interviewing manager said to me, "Have you had any experience in computing?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I've just done several courses in computers in Sydney." "Oh," he said, "I know where we're going to slot you. You can be in the computer area." So I thought, well, that's good. I've got this job. And I spent 8 years there. And my job was to keep the computer systems operating during missions and other times as well. And we had to have a thorough understanding out in that computer section of how computers work from the hardware point of view and from the software point of view. And we also had to have an awareness of the mission and what was expected of the operations during that time. So, 8 years, and I thought, well, this can't go on forever, so that was me. So, there you go.
Thank you. Now, Gillian Schonborn. Some of you would remember her as Gillian Morris when she worked at the tracking station, but Gillian, can you please tell us what you did? Oh, there's a photo of you. Look at that.
Great.
Sorry, I just dropped my thing. Yes, I was a communications technician and operator, and I had also come over to Honeysuckle Creek from a rural valley. I'd only worked there for about 3 months, having spent 4 years in the Navy in communications, and the idea of the Apollo mission seemed much more exciting than the Auroral Valley, which was Earth orbital data. And my job was to send and receive telex messages mainly, and then pass them to the various necessary departments in the station. A lot of them went through the window straight to John in the operations, and then also telemetry and other departments. And I was there until after Apollo 11. I left in the September. I thought, we've done it now, so I can safely leave.
Thank you. Now, I briefly mentioned Honeysuckle, Tidbinbilla and Parkes, but I'm acutely aware that there were many more components, especially here in the ACT, that were involved, and many more teams that were involved in this effort for Apollo 11. So, Mike, as a former deputy director, can you just briefly outline what the other components were, please?
Certainly, Andrew. There's a danger here that I will forget some element. There were so many people involved, even in the Canberra area, let alone the ACT and Australia, but I'll do my best. At Honeysuckle, we had 120-odd people, I think, 25-odd on shift. But in addition, we had Tidbinbilla, the Deep Space Station 42, as it's known in those days, with an identical front end. That's transmitters, receivers, and that sort of equipment. So from the point of view of transmitting and receiving, Tidbinbilla had a major role. And just in passing, it was the one actually providing the two-way communication with Mike Collins when he was orbiting on his own around the moon. And we had the privilege of talking to Mike Collins just a couple of days ago at the Cape. And I mentioned that Australia in particular, because at that time the Gold Sound Station was doing the uplink. But then when we had gotten the signals out of the station, voice, telemetry, data, teletype, it had to get back to Houston. And there was a whole area of hundreds of thousands of people around Australia working to that. PMG, as it was in those days, Telstra into what it's evolved now. So we had voice and data lines that went into Deakin. We had a special ceremony this morning unveiling a plaque that's going to go on this building in Kent Street, Deakin, where all NASA communications went through. So PMG, scattered all over the country, had a big role. And then OTC, in those days, the domestic and international communications were separate. And so when the signal had gone to Sydney, it was then handed over to OTC to send over the Pacific via the Moree ground satellite station. So those are some of the major elements. You see, I'm already forgetting places like Carnarvon. It was quite a small town over there. The tracking station over there, though, was one of the most important in the network. In fact, it was the biggest in the network, and they're having their own 50 celebration over there now. Quite a number of the flight controls at Houston remember Carnarvon well, because in the Gemini days, flight controllers actually visited the stations, were resident of the stations. So people like Ed Fendell and those flight controllers knew it well. And then, of course, there was Parks as a separate additional receiving facility, as Andrew has accurately said. Although the television from Parks was teed off at Sydney and then chosen between either Honeysuckle or Parks, the telemetry, and few people probably know this, was on-sent to Honeysuckle, and we processed the telemetry received at Parks and the voice received at Parks, and we could choose which ones we used. Had there been any scratchy communications, the extra gain of the dish of Parks would have been invaluable for telemetry. As things worked out with the nominal communication links, the extra capability of Parks wasn't really needed or used. And when I talk about all the people involved, there's no limit to it. The fellow used to drive bring the diesel up to the station. The gardeners, the canteen, everybody, and I stress this in all these various interviews I've been going over the last few days, it was a team. Everybody had a part to play, and that included all the stations and all these ground facilities.
Thank you. Now, Honeysuckle, most of you probably are aware of where it is, but it's right up in the high country, in the Australian Capital Territory. Not easy to get to, certainly not back in the day. And can we show the photo, please, of the washaway? It's not up there. Show the photo of the washaway on the main screen, please. Yeah. So this gives you an idea of what could happen on the road up to Honeysuckle. I think this one's of the old Apollo Road, but it literally got to a point where cars would be stopped on either side of a washaway and the duckboards would be brought out. Now, it was also a problem getting to the tracking station nearby a rural valley. Gillian, you've got a story about getting to a rural valley.
Yes, on my very last shift, going out for the midnight shift, there were four of us in the car. We carpooled in company cars, and it was mandatory to wear seatbelts, even though the law didn't apply in general. And it was a moonlit night, and we came across a mob of kangaroos just when we were right on the dirt road in the very steep hill going up. And the driver braked, of course, and the car actually lost control. It flipped and went over down the side of the hill, and all four of us got away without any major injuries. We had cuts and abrasions, but the seat belts definitely saved our lives. So, and it was the next day that I did go to work. It was at Honeysuckle Creek, so I didn't even get any sick leave. But I still do have the scar on my knee to prove it. So.
So I just want to get this straight. This is a kangaroo that caused this?
Yes. No, it was a mob of kangaroo, like about four or five.
I had my four American friends up at Honeysuckle this morning, and they weren't happy because they didn't see a kangaroo, really.
Take them out at
night. Sounds like it's not something to go through. So there's also a problem with snow up there from time to time.
Actually, yes. There's one thing with the car park. We used to tear up the hill and park the car. Everybody would jump out because we sometimes, more than often, are 5 minutes late. So we'd rush in. But what you had to be very careful of, when you stepped out of that car, you could have been standing on about half an inch of ice. And it would have been very embarrassing to have slipped over at that stage on that particular day and broken your ankle. Would have been a very disappointing exercise. So most of us were pretty careful on that, but it was icy.
So somebody told me you lose skin if you touch metal with a bare hand. Is that right?
Something like that. Yeah. Yes.
Does anybody know about bogong moths?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
John?
Yes, Bogon Moss migrated, as probably most people know, from Queensland down to Bogon Mountains, I think, in Victoria, if I remember rightly. Yeah. And there used to be a bit of a hazard. The transmitters in particular had little air vanes to make sure that the cooling air was going properly, and the transmitters wouldn't work if that air was interrupted. And Bogon Moss used to do that. And I remember one time the transmitter tripped off and I had to write the post-mission report. And I wrote, the transmitter was tripped due to a greasy Italian moth. You wouldn't say such things these days, but I got a very
Did that go through to mission control? Or?
Absolutely. And I got an immediate response to that status message, which said, we from the Brotherhood will come and break your kneecaps if you repeat anything about greasy Italian moss. But anyhow, it's good stuff.
Okay, so Honeysuckle was opened in early 1967. And for a while there was nothing to track, which is to say there was no Apollo spacecraft to track. But you guys, under the eagle eye of Tom Reed, the director at the time, were brought up to speed using simulations. So a little bit like an airline pilot, they don't let airline pilots loose in passenger jets to sort of do their practice. I've got a son who's a pilot, they don't do that. They train you up on simulators, and it's only when you can get through a simulator test that they let you into a cockpit. And when they let you into a cockpit, you've got a paying load of passengers. It's just like that. So you were brought up to speed on simulations. So tell me a little bit about that, please, John.
Oh, well, they were an interesting situation, the simulations. There were several types. One type was an aircraft simulating spacecrafts, and they would fly backwards and forwards, and we would track them and treat them like spacecraft. And we had people on the ground watching us, making sure we were doing the right things. These are people who came out in that aircraft. And yes, we were required to do some funny things in those simulations, especially the internal ones, because we could simulate everything in-house, except for the American accents. We weren't very good at that.
We had laconic Australian accents taking first steps on the moon in later years.
G'day, sports, we're on the moon. No, it was fine. But, we had one situation where we set it up that one of the guys in the telemetry area was going to simulate a heart attack. And he fell down and he was very, very good. He simulated a heart attack. The idea was that we had to work around all that and carry him off on a stretcher while everything carried on the same way. So it was transparent to the outside world, but nevertheless, things had happened. And this guy in telemetry, who a lot of you will know, was so good at that that there was another fellow in telemetry who, at the end of this pass, went outside and was sick. He thought it was real. He was so good.
Now, Brian, perhaps I don't know whether you're prepared to talk publicly.
Well, wait a minute. There's all another right. thing with the aircraft. To give you some idea, this was a big aircraft full of Apollo simulation equipment and a crew in it, and it used to fly sometimes around Canberra in circles at various altitudes, and we used to track it with the antenna. Now, we used to do that exercise sometimes at night. And I remember one particular simulation run with this aircraft. We saw in the Canberra Times the next morning lots of people complaining about this mysterious plane flying around. It had a big, bright strobe light underneath so that when we were trying to find it or acquire it, we could see it and we could steer the antenna onto it. Anyway, it flew round and round, and we found that we were getting complaints from all sorts of people, and one of them appeared in the Canberra Times that next morning from Parkwood Eggs. They were complaining that the chooks were refusing to lay, and there was a crisis in eggs. Anyway, that's just a... sorry, Andrew.
No, that's all right. That's a good story. You were right to interrupt me, absolutely. But I want you to tell what I think's a better story. I don't know whether you're prepared to fess up. I know you don't like using the word hack. Are you prepared to fess up about how you hacked the incoming command line?
Oh, Andrew, I was hoping you weren't going to use that dreadful terminology.
I think it's a bit late. Yes. At least for the American government to put you in jail for doing this, and you had all the right intentions, but you better say what
yes,
happened.
Yes, I'll have to confess, we did tap into the command line. Notice I didn't use the same terminology over here, Andrew. I don't know, there might be AFP people in the audience looking for somebody of that ilk. But however, we tapped into the command line because we were having trouble in those days doing a thing called data flow tests. And when it came to doing the command data flow test, we'd be ready. NASA over there at Goddard Space Flight Center would say, "Are you configured, Honeysuckle, for the command affirmative?" And I stand by, and then nothing had happened. And we'd sit there for about several minutes, and they'd come back again and say, "Can you confirm you've got the right operational program loaded into your command computer?" Well, of course we did. You know, fancy that. How ridiculous. Anyway, we went along with it, and they said, "Can you reload your command computer at this point and initialise, etc.?" So we did that. That took about 10 minutes. And we told them we were ready to go again. And away they'd go again with the test, and nothing would happen again. Now, my colleague, Ron Hicks, he may be out there, I hope so. Ron and I looked at the flashing lights on the computer, and I said to Ron, "There's far more information coming in for this three little digit command than there should be." And he said, "Yeah, something funny going on there." And I said, "We need some software to diagnose what they're sending us." And Ron, of course, being senior to me, said, "Okay, you write something that'll read that in." So yours truly had to write something, and we kept that unapproved tampering with the command line in without telling anybody, because that chap Laurie Turner, who John mentioned earlier, he said, "Listen," he said, "if you ever get a good idea, do not tell management." He said, "The first thing you do," he said, "you implement it and you run it and prove that it works, then you tell management." And he said, "That way you short circuit that problem of management saying they want a written proposal, and then it goes to the chief engineer, he wants a diagram with the written proposal, then it goes down to the Department of Supply, Mike.
Now you tell me."
And then... and then they sit on it for a week or two, and after that, you forget it. You know, the problem's gone. What problem are you talking about? Oh, the problem we had 2 weeks ago. So we never told anybody, and we kept running this what we call a patch in the command line so we could do this illicit operation. So I wrote the software, and we analysed it, and we found out they were sending us a lot more information down there than we expected. And I gave it a name because I said, "Well, first of all, we've got the header message, we've got the Apollo command, then we've got the trailer message." Well, that sounded pretty impressive. So we stuck with that for a while. But I didn't know at that stage we were looking at something called metadata. Hey, you hear that on the radio? They've got politicians in Parliament talking about metadata. And what a mess they're making of it. I've never heard such a technical explanation, which meant absolutely nothing. So eventually we had to admit, and in the later missions, that connection became permanent, where my software ended up as being simulation software so that we could simulate spacecraft commands any tick of the clock, any time, for training purposes. And we did that without involving NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center, or Houston. It was a great tool.
This is a very elliptical admission, an elliptical admission that they hacked NASA's most sensitive line. I'll leave it at that. No, he says no.
Well, it's quite possible there might be someone out there from IBM that'll probably come up after and give me a contract.
No, you'll be good. Okay, so
anyway, I'll
sorry.
I was just going to say that Brian's software came in very handy when we had the Americans come over in their super constellations simulating spacecraft, and they were expecting us to do voice and things like that. But all of a sudden, there was Brian commanding the camera up in the aeroplane, watching all these guys up there. They got a heck of a shock out of that.
Well, the camera was sitting there with the other simulation crew, and I was down on the computer, and I discovered that I could command this camera. We could pan it, and we could tilt it up and down, and we could zoom it in and out. And this was great fun, wasn't it, John? Yeah,
absolutely.
Until I scanned down the passageway of the plane past the guys all with their instruments and that, and guess what they had on the door entry into the flight deck? The latest Playboy centerfold. Well, the zoom got a thorough workout, zoomed in and out, and all of a sudden someone who I don't know, I'd love to know who he was, spoilt the whole thing and pulled the plug out somewhere. So that was there. But right. Anyway, the camera did work, we proved that.
We've got to move on. Can I just have the next photo up, please? Now, this is Tom Reed, the station director at the time, and the fellow on the right is George Harris Jr., who was in charge of all simulations. He was the really big bad guy who made these fellows' lives and Gillian's lives hell with all these simulation exercises. And so what Tom is doing here is presenting George Harris Jr. with a set of sandals, and you'll see that the station's wallaby mascot is helping there. And the plaque on the bottom says something like that, to George Harris Jr., in the hope that his feet will stay dry while he walks on water. They had a real sense of humour, these people. And George was British, actually. George was not American. He was British. And I think the British understood... Well, Tom was a Scotsman. I think the British understood Tom's sense of humour better than the NASA people did. Well, the Americans did, I should say. I'm just going to briefly go through the next part. We've got to make up a little bit of ground. The Apollo 11 flight plan was signed off on the 1st of July 1969. It was a 364-page, minute-by-minute timeline for Mission Control and the Apollo astronauts. Around that time, when pushed by somebody in the media, one flight controller said, "We want to stick to the flight plan, but you know how flight plans are. Sometimes you have to change them." And this is what happened. So initially, Tidbinbilla was designated to track the lunar module. So Tidbinbilla would have done lunar TV and all that sort of thing and would have tracked Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon. And Honeysuckle was to track the command module, which was Michael Collins orbiting the moon. But all that changed about 3 days after Apollo 11 blasted off. There was a fire. So can you just very briefly, Mike, just very briefly say what happened with the fire?
Well, one of the transmitters at Tidbinbilla had some
horrible short, burnt up the transmitter. Enormous efforts went in by the staff at Tidbin Builder and around Australia to get spare parts. The transmitter was repaired, and the people who did it deserved medals. However, the confidence of Houston was dented a little bit, and that led to a change in plans. Andrew?
Thanks. So what we've got here is we've got the flight plan, and from here on it just is constantly changing because of different circumstances, and leads to a point where it was Honeysuckle, contrary to all expectation, that was right in the hot seat when Armstrong was at the bottom of the ladder. So the next thing that happened, we're moving now to the day of the landing. We're moving now to the 21st of July 1969 in Australia, on the East Coast, and the 20th of July in the United States, where it was getting towards evening on the 20th of July. Now, one of the next thing that happened, I should say this, the flight plan designated that the moonwalk would take place at 4 p.m. on the 21st of July, Eastern Australian time. And that meant that Parkes would be the primary receiver. Parkes was all set up and the media was full of Parkes. Well, the media is still full of Parkes, but I won't go there. The media was full of Parkes being the downlink for Lunar TV. And indeed it was. I mean, it had this massive dish and it was all good to go. And Honeysuckle would be its backup while playing a primary role, receiving telemetry and such like. And by 4 p.m, the Goldstone station in California would have lost the signal, would have been out of view of the moon. So the lunar module lands at 6:15 in the morning, Eastern Australian time, on the 21st of July, and all is proceeding according to plan. And then sometime around 8 a.m, tell us what happened, Brian, briefly if you can. You were listening on Net 1.
Yes, I was listening on Net 1 and I noticed that in the operations room, the three people in there weren't paying attention to Net 1. They were sorting out some other problem. And periodically out in the computer room, we could relax and listen to all sorts of other conversations. And I heard this on Net 1 and I thought, my God, that's a massive change. That's going to be really complicated. So I could see John, he's had his head through the glass window into the comms room and he's having a great chat with somebody. And I'm waving at him. And I'm going, Net 1. And he's caught my eye straight away and I could see him go to the console and then he's talking away after that. And I thought, oh, that's good, he's picked it up. But when you think of the sophistication of our headsets, and we could listen on about 7 or 8 channels at once and we could differentiate the conversations, it required a hand signal to get from the computer room into the operations room so that John could pick up Net 1 and listen to the astronauts suddenly changing the flight plan. I thought that was pretty neat.
I'm sure that we were
he's going to deny it.
We were discussing something very...
Oh, very, very important. Of course, John.
so what was changed here was they were told, or the flight plan said, you're coming out at 4 p.m. Armstrong and Aldrin must have had a bit of a chat about it after they landed in the lunar module and decided that if Mission Control thought they were going to hang around and have a rest for 6 hours rather than step out on the moon as soon as they could, Mission Control was not realistic. And so they basically said to Mission Control, we want to come out as soon as we can. And Mission Control realised that if Armstrong wanted to come out, he'd come out whenever he liked. There was nothing Mission Control could tell him to do to stop him. And so basically he was given permission to come out when he was ready. When he and Aldrin were ready, they were given permission to come out. And this threw things into a state of confusion because everything had to be recalibrated. Everything had to be brought forward. So, Gillian, you were in the comms room. tell us what it was like. There was stuff incoming and outgoing in a tsunami, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, telexes and paper just kept coming through in a mad flurry because there was all these changes, and so they had to, things had to be distributed around the station to all the operations areas. So it was a great papers are going everywhere and new instructions happening, and so we were on our toes for that.
Mm-hmm. You earned your money at that time. But you got it done.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
You all got it done. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Tom Reed, the station director, had a surprise up his sleeve for these people. Not a surprise that he was happy with, but he'd been contacted the previous afternoon by the Prime Minister's office. And the Prime Minister, John Gorton, wanted to come on a station tour on the morning of the moonwalk. Well, Tom was not happy about this, but he had to work both sides of the street. He had to keep the government happy, and he had to keep the trackers happy. And he had an inkling that the trackers would be furious if they knew that the Prime Minister was going to ruin their morning. And so he didn't tell anybody that the Prime Minister was coming. And so the Prime Minister turns up at Honeysuckle Creek in his Bentley, flying the Australian flag and all this stuff, with an entourage, with some very senior NASA people, with his security detail, with Ainsley Gatto, who some of you might remember, and various other people, and also, much to Tom Reed's horror, an ABC TV film crew. So Tom takes one look at the sound recording equipment that the sound recorder's got, and says, "You're not bringing that stuff into my operations room." So the poor sound recorder was left to cool his heels in reception with Ainsley Gatto. So the Prime Minister came into the operations room with Tom and proceeded to be introduced to people. So if we could have photo I up, please. So here's the Prime Minister with, it's Paul Mullen. Yeah, Paul Mullen, who's the servo operator. So the Prime Minister's busy waggling the dish around. You saw the Collins video a minute ago, so he's waggling the dish around, right? That's pretty helpful.
With a trackball.
Yeah, of 9 o'clock. And that's the trackball there, which is now behind here. Okay, so next one, he goes, show photo J, please. So here we are in the operations control room, and the Prime Minister's standing there with Tom Reed, and in the foreground is a pretty angry-looking John Saxon. So, John, just tell us what was going on there.
Everybody's
smoked. Well, we did find out that he was coming around eventually, and it was right in the middle of our countdown, testing out the station for the biggest day of the year. And I didn't think it was a very good idea at all. However, we put up with it, but the thing I like about that photo, not only the handsome guy in the front.
Sorry, who's that? Who's that?
Oh, it was 50 years ago, but have you noticed, this was a tiny room, and almost airtight, and everybody is smoking.
Of course.
It was blue in there, as bad as Houston. Yeah, so, well, they went away eventually and we got on with the job.
I've got a 10-second theory on this. We all smoked in those days. I was 2 packets a day and we got to the moon. Now nobody smokes and we don't get to the moon. There's some correlation there.
Somebody could write a PhD on that.
So what have they got to smoke to get to Mars, Mike?
Well, cigars, I suppose.
Eh? All right, so next photo, please. Now, this is an important photo in the sense that this is the Prime Minister talking to Ed Von Renoir, who was the TV technician at Honeysuckle Creek. And just above Ed's head there, I don't know if you can make it out, there is a switch, and it's got a Dymo label above it, a little printed label. It's got a Dymo label underneath it. That is the reversing switch. And depending on whether or not the TV technician remembered to flip the switch, the world either would see a photo that was upside down or a photo that was right side up, okay? So that little switch is everything. Next one, please.
Andrew, can I just...
Yeah, sure.
I was just going to say that we could simulate absolutely everything that happened.
Except a prime ministerial visit, right?
No. I'm talking now about the TV.
Okay.
Nobody knew what that TV was going to look like.
Yeah.
Nobody at Houston or on the stations.
Yeah.
And it was quite amazing that Ed was able to recognise the fact that, you know, that's the sky and that's the the lunar surface.
Yep.
He was really good, tweaked it up. But, as Mike will always say, it was a team effort, wasn't it, Mike?
This one is, now, as a former lawyer politician, this is about the only photograph I've ever seen in connection with Honeysuckle Creek that I instinctively understood, right? All the others had to be explained to me. I instinctively understand this because this is a politician with a photo opportunity. This is a prime minister with a photo opportunity. I used to try and do the same thing at my little lowly level. And I gather that the dish was moved out of its tracking alignment to facilitate Gorton's photo opportunity here. So when he left, I think it was just before 10 a.m. or something, everybody was glad to see him go. Do you have any memory of him, Gillian, being there?
Well, actually, I know he was there, and but I think we were just too busy to even take too much, because it's not a big memory that I have of him being there. I certainly know he was there, but no, I think we were just too busy doing our job to take much notice of him. Sorry.
Okay, so we're now in a situation where Gorton's gone, the astronauts are suiting up. Andy, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but suiting up is a very serious business because essentially you're turning yourself into a little mini spacecraft. You're taking everything that supports you as a living human being outside into an incredibly hostile environment. And unless you're suited up absolutely, hermetically sealed, so to speak, with everything working, you'll die a horrible death. So Armstrong and Aldrin took their time to suit up, and the clock was ticking. So it was estimated initially that Armstrong would emerge from the lunar module at about 11 a.m. and this was right at the time when Honeysuckle would be getting a signal. So right up including to the time that Gorton was visiting, Honeysuckle did not have a signal from the moon. It wasn't in view. But everybody was very, very busy getting ready for when that moment came. So it was initially anticipated that Armstrong would be coming down the ladder right around when Honeysuckle was getting its first image. When it's getting its first signal. So this is a pretty fraught time. But that time came and went. So 11 a.m. came and went, and Armstrong and Aldrin were still busy suiting up. So, Mike, you were putting the station through its paces, and I think the culmination of all this was Network, Honeysuckle, our status is green.
Yes, well, I came on shift at the acquisition time, and we all recognised it was going to be the biggest pass we'd ever done. Certainly up till that point, turned out the biggest pass we ever did, half a century later. And we were in constant contact with Houston, and we didn't go through these Gene Kranz type of rat-a-tat-tat things. I worked on a principle of negative reporting. In other words,
say as little as possible.
That was my philosophy of what it was worth, that I cut back all, as much feel-good, positive reporting as I could and made sure there was room for the necessary reporting. So, yes, I reported the station green for the upcoming pass.
Okay, so you've got moonrise over Honeysuckle at 11:15 a.m., I think it was. And the station picks up the Eagle's downlink signal. and everything's working perfectly.
Yep.
Now, at this point, the Parkes dish is not in view of the moon. It's not in view of Tranquility Base. So just to explain this a little bit, Canberra and Parkes are on the same longitude, which is to say, if you drive due north from Canberra, eventually you'll get to Parkes. It also means, generally speaking, that the moon will rise over Canberra at the same time that it rises over Parkes, and therefore Honeysuckle too. Now, it's different with the dishes, because the Honeysuckle dish was a tracking dish, and it could be angled down to 0 degrees, so it could be angled right down to the horizon. The Parkes dish, being a radio telescope, could only be angled down to 30 degrees above the horizon. And for every 15 degrees elevation, NASA had a rule, it was an extra hour until moonrise. So putting all this in plain English, although the moon rose over Parkes and Canberra at the same time, it rose over the Honeysuckle dish 2 hours before it rose over the Parkes dish. And this is critical also in this story. So Hamish Lindsay is here, one of our most distinguished former trackers, who's written a wonderful book. Now, one of Hamish's many talents was as a commercial photographer. So he wasn't just a great tracker, he was also a commercial photographer. And Tom Reid had designated him, well, to follow the Prime Minister around in the morning, taking all sorts of shots of Gorton. And then, just before Armstrong stepped onto the moon, he sent Hamish out to take a photograph of the dish. So Tom was an engineer, but he also had a keen sense of history. So we got the next photo up, please, of the dish. That's Hamish's photo of the dish at Honeysuckle, taken right at the time Armstrong was coming down the ladder, and they were getting a strong signal at that time. So I'm sorry, I've got to get through a little bit of this. So Armstrong crawls backwards across a metal platform once he's emerged from the lunar module, and he crawls towards a ladder which is attached to one of the landing struts. As he gets to the top of the ladder, he pulls on a D-ring, a lanyard, and the lanyard activates the automatic TV camera. So the TV camera, once activated, is exposed to the bottom of the ladder as the stowage bay in which it's placed flips out and down. And the little camera is upside down and starts filming from an upside down position. Now, I'm going to show you some footage in a minute, but I better try and explain what you're going to see first, because this is really the heart and soul of what happened. This is the proof to me that it was Honeysuckle that did the business, not Parkes. Okay, this remains a big issue for me, all right? These guys are much more relaxed about it. I get a bit toey about Parkes. No. So this is actually the proof. So what you'll see in a minute, a black and white video. It's not of the best quality, but think back to what your TV quality was like in 1969, okay? And then think that this TV signal is travelling over 250,000 miles to get here, and then being transmitted cables, microwaves, all sorts of other things from Honeysuckle to Houston and then out to the world. So what you'll see, first of all, when it comes on, is you'll see a section of a big room with a screen in the corner, a massive screen in the corner, which is a whole lot of blocks. That's Mission Control. Then you'll see an indecipherable picture suddenly comes on, And that's Goldstone, and you'll hear the Goldstone person saying, Goldstone online. And the second later, although you won't see the picture, you'll hear Mike Dinn say, it's all right, don't go away. You'll see Mike Dinn say, you'll hear Mike Dinn say, Honeysuckle online. What you're seeing is what was going out to the world. At that point, Honeysuckle was not going out to the world, although its image could be seen at Mission Control. What was going out to the world then was Goldstone. You'll see, obviously, that there are some problems with this footage that they were sending. Amongst other things, it was upside down. I remember this, I was at school, I was watching it. And then you'll hear the TV technician at Mission Control say something to the effect of, have you flipped your reversing switch? And then it's flipped and then it flips round to the right way. But unfortunately, the poor technician at Goldstone has been twiddling with his dials in the meantime to try and correct what he thinks are other errors. And so even though the footage is right side up, it's still a mess. And then you'll see, about 1 minute, 50 seconds into this little video clip, you will see all of a sudden the picture becomes clearer. And a second or so after that, you'll hear the technician at Mission Control say, all stations, we've switched video to Honeysuckle. And that's the world from that point is seeing the Honeysuckle video. And then you'll see Armstrong step onto the moon and say what he said, and all that's from Honeysuckle. So perhaps we can just go to the video of Armstrong's first step, please, and I won't say any more. It's 2 minutes 47 seconds running time, by the way. There are a couple of gaps, but you'll see. Can we go to the video, please?
Spot clear. Roger.
Man,
we're getting a picture on
the TV.
Online. You had a good picture, huh? There's a great deal of contrast in it, and currently it's upside down on our monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
Ghost on video, Houston TV.
Ghost on video, go ahead.
Can you confirm that your reverse switch is in the proper position
okay,
with the camera being upside
position,
down?
We're in reverse.
Is that what?
Roger, thank you.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now. Okay, I just checked getting back up to that first step. It hasn't collapsed too far, but it's adequate to get back up.
Roger, we copy.
That's a pretty good little jump.
Buzz, this is Houston. F2, 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
Okay. I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches.
All stations, we are switching radio to Honeysuckle.
Very, very fine grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the lamb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's it.
Just a little technical interest there, which you may or may not have picked up. Did you notice the horizon was tilted? Tilted about 15 degrees. That's because the camera, although it was upside down, it wasn't absolutely vertical upside down. One of the early pictures you saw there And so the ladder is shown as appreciably steeper than otherwise. And anybody and everybody around the world has only ever seen that shot with the tilted tilted camera view. However, Carl McKellar, is Carl here?
Yes.
Carl, our whiz and Honeysuckle Creek net, I said to Carl one day, hey, Carl, can you correct that video to get rid of that 15 degrees? It's not, yeah. It's called not only absolute ultimate in the space nut, but he's also a real whiz on the computers. And there is, on Cole's website, a corrected version of that video with that 15-degree tilt taken out, and the ladder nothing like as vertical as you see it on the screen. Little bit of anecdote there, just Andrew.
Okay, so I just want to ask each of you now, did you have any idea that Armstrong was stepping onto the moon when he did from the positions you were in? And when did you sort of first see that footage? So if I could just ask each of you in turn.
Well, yes, briefly, we knew exactly what was happening, although, as John said, we didn't really know quite what...
You had a monitor up in front of you.
We did. The observer, we had a monitor. But I'm not going to belabor the point, but frankly, my big worry at that particular instant was intermittent biomedical data coming down. And I was very worried that that was a problem with us. However, I could work two jobs at once, I suppose, look at the TV and worry about the biomed at the same time. And I knew that everybody had done their thing to that point anyway.
Well, when you're spending... What was it? Oh, gosh, I don't know. Billions and billions of American taxpayers' dollars. You're in the PR business, whether you like it or not. So that's, you know, it was, I guess, putting on a show as much as anything else just at that particular time.
Whether we realise it or not, but go on.
Brian, what were you doing at that moment?
At that moment, I was still concerned about all those people in the computer room. Anyway, they were standing behind me, just inside the door. And I've, ever since that day, I've referred to them as the Terracotta Warriors because they were absolutely mesmerised at the big TV above the computer equipment and big black and white, 21-inch. And they nobody was moving. They were like statues. And I'm so glad I let them stay there.
Gillian, did you see any of this? Or
I was one of the Terracotta Warriors.
Oh, I didn't know.
We snuck down from comms and we're just having a look from
but
the background.
Do you remember them all?
Yeah.
And you were in the ops room, John.
Even the gardener that we employed got off his lawnmower and left it outside and came in to have a look. I mean, gee, that's...
And you were in the ops room, John, with Mike.
Yes, it was an interesting moment, mainly because I was trying to make sure I knew exactly to the second when Armstrong stepped onto the moon, mainly because we had a sweepstake going. You know, who won the money? I don't know. I don't know if there was any money involved, but anyhow, I did note it down to the second.
And just by the by, although there might have been 600, well, were 600 million people watching television, we couldn't watch television. We did not have a television set at Honeysuckle because you can't receive television, couldn't receive television there. You still can't receive television there. You still can't receive a mobile phone signal there. Very insulated. So we had no choice but to look at the monitors coming down of the real time, but... no television.
Can we just get the the New York crowd up, please? Okay, so this is a small group of the huge crowd in Central Park, New York. It was about 10 p.m. on a sultry summer's evening, the 20th of July, and those people are looking at massive TV monitors set up by the CBS network, and what they're watching is Honeysuckle's TV feed of Armstrong stepping onto the moon. And the amazing thing is that there were, well, just as in Australia back then, there were deep divisions within the community about the Vietnam War, And what I think's most amazing about this photo is it just captures the moment when everybody was one, when the war was just for a second perhaps put to the back of people's minds and they were celebrating a really extraordinary achievement in history. So they're watching the honeysuckle video feed. If we could just go to photograph O, please. Next one. As Mike would say, this is the heart and soul of what Honeysuckle and Tidbinbilla and all the others were all about. This is actually a graph. So this is some of the telemetry coming down, signed off by Tom Reed there. And it's actually showing Armstrong and Aldrin's EKGs at the time Armstrong stepped onto the moon. So he's at 112 and Aldrin is at 81. It's this type of information that was just critical back at Mission Control, and this is, as I say, the essence of what Honeysuckle did. Now, even though he can't be here, I really would like Tom Reed to say something. And so Tom never talked about what he did. He was the director of the tracking station. He never talked about what he did, except as far as I know, in public on one occasion, and that was over the way there at the Lakeside Hotel in 1989 at the 20th anniversary of Apollo 11. And it was there that he said, really for the only time in public I know, what actually happened. So we'll just let him speak for himself, but just before we do that, he was Glaswegian. He's not that easy to follow. A bit easier than Mike Dinn, who's a Yorkshireman.
Big difference.
But you'll have to listen carefully to get it. So anyway, can we play that video, please?
Because of the decision to change the mission timeline, namely that Neil Armstrong came out earlier than planned, it turned out that the slow scan television and the voice was relayed through the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station to Houston when Neil Armstrong stepped out on the moon. To me, and I'm sure to many people who were at the station at that time, that seemed to be a highlight. And it seemed to make everything worthwhile. It hadn't been planned that way. That's the way it was. God damn it, we were ready.
Just in case you didn't get that last bit, he said it hadn't been planned that way, but that's the way it was, and God damn it, we were ready. And it sort of summarises, I think, the whole thing very well. Now, there's one final photograph, and I want Gillian to point out where she is in this photo. Right?
Yes. Sorry about that. Just say the orange shirt.
I don't think I have to say much. It's right in the centre front. And when I first saw that photograph in Andrew's book, and I was absolutely amazed. I have no recollection of being in that position in that photograph, and I don't know why I was.
Well, that's the Honeysuckle team. That was taken about a month after the...
And one of the people not on that is the person happening to take that photo.
Yes.
Hamish.
Oh, plus another one. Yeah. Mr. Saxon was skiving off somewhere, and he's not on there.
Taking well-deserved break.
He was photoshopped on.
I did try and photoshop him into this picture one time, but I'm not very skilled.
You didn't miss out, John Lennon.
Now, before asking Dr. Andrew Thomas to... say a few words. I'd just like to thank the trackers who are here and all the trackers in the room and some trackers who are not, some trackers who are no longer with us for helping inform me through what they've said and written over the years. Allowed me to write a book about Honeysuckle Creek. But there are also a couple of people that I just want to thank individually. One is Colin McKellar, who Mike has already referred to, who has curated a wonderful website called The Tribute to Honeysuckle Creek. If by any chance you haven't had a look at that website, do yourselves a favour and have a look at it. It is a marvellous thing. When I finished my book, or the manuscript, I needed a technical reader. In other words, I needed somebody to tell me where I got technical stuff wrong. And when I said to these guys, I think I'm going to get Colin McKellar to be my technical reader, you've got to understand, Colin is trained professionally as a geologist, but he's also an Anglican minister, and he's not a tracker. He hasn't been a tracker. But they all said there is nobody better than Colin McKellar to read your technical, the technical aspects of your book. He knows more about tracking than we do, and I've come to realise how true that is. Secondly, and I didn't mean it for it to be in this order, Hamish, but your contribution to this story of Honeysuckle Creek and space tracking generally is just phenomenal. Hamish wrote a book which tracked every single mission up to and including all Apollo missions and missions and beyond, and it's absolutely on the money technically. It's a great read, and that scholarship, together with the photographs that you took over the years for Tom, and Tom knew what he was doing in appointing you to that job, have helped to provide so many of the images that are being used today all around the world to explain what happened.
And by the way, Andrew, Hamish's book is still on sale. I happened to get a second copy just 3 or 4 weeks ago, so those of you who have not got it, it's on sale at Amazon. I don't get anything for saying.
It's well worth it. Also, another person. I'm sorry. There's two more people to go. The Honourable Margaret Reed AO, who would be known to everybody in Canberra as a former senator of the ACT and also president of the Australian Senate. Margaret Reed. It's her late husband Tom, who was the director. And I could say to you, Margaret, you're out there somewhere. Oh yes. Gosh, you hide well. Just to thank you and all your family for the most extraordinary support that you've given to me in this project. They all insisted that I send all draft chapters of my book to them for approval, but the red pen didn't come out very often, and I thank you for that. And finally, in terms of the manuscript I produced, which was in many respects an unwieldy mess, I would like to thank my friend Charlotte Rogers-Brown, who is here from Phoenix, Arizona tonight, for her assistance in telling me what needed to be cut out, which was about a third of the manuscript. So I'd like to thank you too, Charlotte. Now, it's my great privilege to ask Dr. Andrew Thomas to come to the stage. I have tried to figure out what a suitable introduction for you would be, and I've sort of got it down to this. Andrew spent 177 days and 9 hours and some extra minutes in space in his total career. Neil Armstrong spent 8 days and 14 hours in space. So it's an amazing career that Andrew has had, and we are all extremely honoured to have him amongst us tonight. And I'd also like to thank the American Embassy, the representatives from the United States government who are here tonight as well, for helping to facilitate and fund Dr. Thomas's trip out here to be with us, both here and quite rightly also in Parkes. So, Dr. Thomas, would you come and say a few words, please? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I may have more spaceflight time than Neil, but I would happily trade places with him. Those are fabulous stories. Thank you so much for sharing them with and give us some insight into that amazing event. As we've been approaching the 50th anniversary of Apollo, there's been a lot of talk in the media about what Apollo really achieved and what its major legacy is. And different authorities have different things to say. You can find claims like, thank God for Apollo because it gave us Velcro and Teflon. And you can find other equally absurd statements. But in the bigger sense, Apollo has left a legacy of profound social and economic change in a decade known most for economic change. But if you read all these articles about Apollo, one thing they all agree on was that Apollo was history-making, and that it was a defining and optimistic event in the 20th century and it changed humanity's view of our place in the universe. Indeed, those of us who are around in those days can all remember what we were doing, where we were when we watched Neil take that one small step. And although Apollo was a NASA undertaking by the US, it enthralled the whole world and captured everyone's imagination. The world stopped to watch those grainy black and white images coming from the moon as we saw. And you could just see in those people from New York Central Park how uplifted they were by the whole event. Everyone was utterly spellbound throughout the world. But that was another time and another generation. And as a result, I think few today may realize what we've been talking about, that those historic images came from Australian tracking station at Honeysuckle Creek. This country was in the critical path that provided communication links, as we've heard, when those other NASA facilities, being on the other side of the Earth, were facing away from the moon. And were it not for the dedicated work of the tracking teams here in Australia, NASA access to all that important telemetry stream and reporting vehicle status would have been restricted to just a few hours a day. As a result, the entire mission sequence and timing of critical events, such as undocking, descent initiation, and actual touchdown, have all had to have been changed. And at the very best, Neil and Buzz would not have been able to start working on the surface when they did. I was a student when Apollo landed at the university, and I remember one of the ABC Current Affairs programs did a piece on the Australian contribution and the importance of that contribution. And I remember as a young engineering student feeling a sense of incredible pride that this nation had played a role, such an important role, placing it firmly in the critical path to the mission's success. And I'm sure many others shared that view and that sense of pride. So to all of you who were directly involved in that effort here on stage and in the audience, we must offer our profound thanks for your skills and your professionalism. And I have to say that I'm a little jealous of you all. It must have been an unbelievable time to be part of that history in the making, and it certainly helped inspire people like me to pursue a career in space. But mostly, my thanks and our thanks to you for lifting the international profile of this nation and lifting our collective spirits by making us all contributors to that wonderful and historic event. You gave us an incredible boost in national pride. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Just some closing comments from me. So firstly, to thank our panellists and Andrew for what has been a fantastic evening. Thank you very much. I did want to let you know that we do have for sale just around in front of the shop Andrew's book, if you would like to get a copy. And I'd also like to take this opportunity to announce that the National Museum here has now designated the tracking of Apollo as one of the National Museum's defining moments in Australian history. It should come up on our screen. So go to our website to see more information, please. I'd also like to point out to you a particular interest over here towards my right, your left, the satellite tracking system console from the Auroral Valley Tracking Station, which is now part of the National Museum's collection. And please don't forget to come back. As Andrew mentioned, behind here, and we've covered it up unfortunately tonight because of broadcast limitations, we have a display of amazing technical equipment that was used. So some of that equipment includes the handsets and transmitter panels, the trackball that you saw in the videos earlier today that moved the honeysuckle dish, as well as lots of personal memorabilia from honeysuckle trackers, and of course our moon rock, part of the Goodwill rock brought back by the astronauts of Apollo 17. Additionally, throughout Science Week, through until mid-August, we will have a number of public lectures here at the museum on the role of the Australian tracking stations. Those lectures titled Tracking Apollo, How a Little Dish in Canberra Broadcast the First Steps on the Moon, will be run over a few lecture times, so check our website for more details. And lastly, thanks to you all for coming tonight. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.